Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. We begin this morning's broadcast by remembering that a year ago Israeli bombs were falling on Gaza. To mark this one-year anniversary of that tragic assault by Israel, Rifat Al-Ra and Leila El-Haddad have co-edited an anthology published by Just World Books called Gaza Unsilenced. Here are some excerpts from their introductory essay on the anthology that encapsulates the horror of Operation Protective Edge. On July 7, 2014, Israel launched a colossal ground, air, and naval assault on the Gaza Strip, the tiny Palestinian coastal enclave Israel controls. This was the third, and to date, the worst such assault waged by Israel against Gaza since 2008. It was an outrageous act of premeditated aggression to which the Israeli government gave the Orwellian name Operation Protective Edge. In the course of 51 dark days, nearly 2,200 Palestinians were killed. About a quarter of them were children, many of whom were deliberately targeted. 142 families lost two or more members. About 11,000 Gaza Palestinians were injured, maimed, or permanently disfigured. Israeli bombardment destroyed or severely damaged 18,000 housing units, displacing nearly 20,000 Palestinian families, comprised of about 108,000 men, women, and children. It also flattened about 17,000 hectares of crops and decimated the agricultural infrastructure that sustains life, irrigation systems, animal farms, and greenhouses. This relentless pummeling was directed at a population still recovering from the two preceding Israeli attacks, Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009 and Operation Pillar of Cloud in 2012, and reeling from an illegal and debilitated seven-year-long siege and blockade that shattered livelihoods and deliberately impoverished the residents. Put them on a diet, in Israeli parlance. 72% of Gaza's residents were described by UN bodies as food insecure or vulnerable, that is, lacking access to sufficient and nutritious food to feed their families, and nearly half unemployed. This same population, along with their brethren in the rest of Israel and abroad in diaspora, had already endured 66 years of displacement and dispossession, almost half a century of Israeli military occupation involving continuing settler colonialism and decades of closures and movement restrictions. And yet, if we were to believe the popular discourse in the mainstream Western media, Gaza had it coming. And by some perverse and morally vacuous logic, its residents were to blame for their suffering. How can we truly understand the situation in Gaza as a means to understanding the situation in Palestine more broadly? How can we understand a place that is encircled from every angle, continuously and systematically assailed to rally voters in Israel, or to teach a lesson, or in other obscene Israeli expressions, to mow the lawn, to trim those unruly, defiant hedges. Whenever Gaza is hit, It is a thrust anew into the media limelight, and its residents are recast into the double roles of both victim and villain. Gaza, we fear, has been reduced to an allegory and an abstraction. We are inundated with figures and numbers attempting to depict for us what life is like in this tiniest of places. How can words convey that which numbers and images and characters on online posts cannot? No matter how valiantly, how do we provide an accurate and humanistic, a real narration of the Palestinian story that is Gaza? In Gaza Unsilenced, we attempt to do just this. We set out to compile a compelling collection of some of the best writing, photography, tweets, art, and poems from that harrowing time and the year that followed, to depict as truthfully and as inclusively as possible that which was done to Gaza, what the impact has been on both the people and the land, and how they are coping under a still exigent siege. That was an excerpt from the introductory essay by Rifat Alakrar and Leila El Haddad to their just published anthology named Gaza Unsilenced and published by Just World Books. This morning we feature a presentation by Serene Murad, who was born in the United States but was raised in Palestine. Her mother is American, her father is Palestinian. She has completed her freshman year at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. Her story is interesting, and through it we get a realistic view of life in both Jerusalem and in the West Bank. Serene spoke to a peace action group in Natick, and it was recorded by our colleague Stan Robinson for This Week in Palestine. Some of the presentation is question and answer, and the audio volume varies, but bear with us. We have tried to present it in a way that would be clear for our listeners. Here is Serene Murad speaking in Natick, Massachusetts.
My name's Serene. I have two younger sisters, one 16 and one is 11. My father is Palestinian. He was born in a small village near Nazareth, and my mom's American. I was born in America, actually. I was born in Newton, and I lived here until I was 8. I moved to Jerusalem when I was 8 and enrolled in just a public school there. That first year was probably the worst year of my life because my parents decided the best way to learn the language was to be put in an all-Arabic school. The teachers didn't speak English, the kids didn't speak English, no one spoke English, and I didn't speak a word of Arabic. So that wasn't very fun. Not a fun year for me. But because I was immersed in that culture that way, I learned really fast. And the year after that, I moved to a new school, also in Jerusalem, and got the hang of it by then, had learned the language, found some friends. We lived in Jerusalem up until the middle of my senior year. So we didn't move to the West Bank until the middle of my senior year. And then we moved to the West Bank because in my junior year of high school, I changed schools from the high school I was in, which was in Jerusalem, in the Old City, to the Friends School, which is the only Palestinian school that offers the IB curriculum. And my parents thought it was really important to get a better education than the one I was getting. There's a really big problem with education in Palestine because the level isn't very high to begin with. And then, it was a private school because at most of the public schools, the kids don't even learn. They go to school in the morning, but then are dismissed at 10, 11 a.m. The teachers hit the children. They don't really learn anything. Most kids don't go off to college after. And there are a lot of private schools and none of them are expensive. They're not for the upper class like they are here. They're really middle class oriented. A lot of scholarships offered, so it's just a different alternative. But when I moved to the new school, the Friends, with the IB curriculum, it was a completely different way of learning. At my old school, it was based on memorization. We had set subjects. You weren't allowed to choose at all. So in my new school, I got to choose what subjects I got to learn. More or less, I had a few options. It was the first time in 10 years I had taken an English class. So going back to English was really interesting because I knew I wanted to go to college outside of Palestine, Israel, because I really value the kind of education you have here where it's asking you to think yourself instead of asking you to understand someone else's words. So I think that's something really unique. A lot of my friends haven't been able to leave because they haven't been granted visas, or they haven't been let out of Israel, or they don't have the money. So I'm really fortunate to be able to come here. I go to Wesleyan University in Connecticut. I really like it. I just finished my first year. I think I learned a lot. I wasn't exposed to most of the things. Like, I took an anthropology course, which was really interesting. Had never done that before. Government. So a lot of really new things on that side. So, yeah, that's kind of an introduction. My dad is the oldest of 11. So my dad has, because he's born in a tiny village near Nazareth, when in 1948 and then in 1967 when they tried to kick all the Palestinians out, this little village wasn't relevant enough, and because they refused to leave, it wasn't worth fighting them over it, and the whole village stayed and got granted Israeli citizenship. So my dad is a citizen of Israel, a Palestinian citizen of Israel, which means I also have a Israeli passport as well as an American passport, so dual citizenship. The Israeli passport allows me to do a lot of things that most of my friends can't. One of them is going through checkpoints. I don't know how much background information you have. I'm not going to get too much into it, but there are checkpoints all over Israel or Palestine, which you need a special ID card to go through. The way it works is you get out of the vehicle you're in, you have to walk through the checkpoint, you put your bags in a security check, you walk through metal gates, and then you put your passport on the window, and they check it for you and say whether you can go or not. So it allows me to leave and enter Ramallah, which is where I live. But it allows me to also to go to Jerusalem to see my friends because they live in Jerusalem. It also allows me to leave the country. So basically I'm in a very, very lucky situation that a lot of my friends aren't in. I think when you're a kid, you're less aware of how things affect you and kind of think that they're the norm. I had a very strange experience that most people don't have. When I came back to America during the summer, and then I'd go back home, it was a really, really different experience in terms of culture shock and just really adapting to two completely different situations. So I think that's a pretty special circumstance that even people who have some kind of connection with America don't really have that really direct contact of being in two places in a very short period of time. So that was really interesting. My sister, who is 16, actually got a full scholarship to Sidwell University in D.C. So she is there. She just finished, actually. So she's going home and will have to finish her high school there. And not so surprising, she doesn't want to leave because the whole month leading up to our departure, she's been telling me it's so much easier to live in America. And it's true, because there aren't checkpoints. You don't have to worry about the military all over, everywhere. There is access to a lot of different things we don't have here. Culturally, it's so much more open. It's a more open society. There's a huge cultural difference that kind of allows you to be so much more free here than you are there. So she doesn't want to go home. She's going to have to, of course, so she's not looking forward to that. But that contact with America and Palestine was really, really special. I think I've always been aware of the political situation there because you listen to the news and you hear about things and you're experiencing the checkpoints every day, so you have that contact, but I'm not sure when I fully understood the whole how big the impact of the occupation was on me. And I think the contrast to America really helped me realize it, because it really is so much easier to live here. This past summer, last year's summer, was probably the hardest I have ever experienced there, because everything changed with when the three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped. I'm sure you heard about it on the news, it was here, but that kind of started a sequence of things that in a completely unstable situation just became a lot more unstable. So I think I was at an age where I really understood what was happening, and with all of the escalation of things, it just turned into a very, very big learning experience for me. Because I live in Jerusalem and my school's, well, I lived in Jerusalem and my school was in the West Bank, every day when I'd want to go home, I'd have to wait in a checkpoint for three and a half hours to get back to my house because of the number of people. And then sometimes they would close the checkpoints because they're not under any obligation to keep them open. There were a lot of protests leading up to the summer, even before the summer, where you'd have to walk past tear gas, rocks being thrown, sometimes rubber bullets. So that's the main reason why we ended up moving to the West Bank, because it was closer to my school. So going through the checkpoint every day just really wears on you, really hard, which is why we moved. There are a lot of differences between the West Bank and Jerusalem. A lot of differences that I can go into if you guys are interested in hearing about them. Yeah? Okay, so differences between Jerusalem and the West Bank. People who live in the West Bank live there because they can't leave. So 90% of the time. There are the exception, like my family, where we can choose to live in Jerusalem, but we choose to live in the West Bank. But most of the people live there because they don't have the proper papers to allow them to live anywhere else. So it's really kind of like a big cage, where when you're inside, you have the illusion of being free because there are no Israelis there. There are inner checkpoints. It's not true that there aren't, but there's a lot more. You're allowed to go around inside this kind of circular area, but you're still not allowed to leave. So at the end of the day, it is still a kind of a cage situation. The people in the West Bank are of two classes, either extremely wealthy because they made deals with Israelis and got into huge positions of power. Those are the ministers, huge positions of power, and they are not opposed to the occupation because they're benefiting from it, because they have these high jobs, high paying positions, and they're the ones with the most power. So that's kind of another reason why nothing ever changes there. Then you have the middle class, and then you have the refugees. There's a huge refugee population, and the refugees live in pretty bad conditions, where you have 10, 15 people living in probably a space smaller than the one we're in right now, with sometimes no water, no electricity. It really depends. There are, in the refugee camps, currently all the time there are military invasions where the army will come in, either because they heard there was like some kind of suspicious activity, or because someone's been too vocal and they want to have the situation calm down. So pretty bad living conditions. Middle class, I would say, not as much direct contact, and then the upper class are benefiting. We have a lot of friends in the refugee camps, and when we went to visit them, he was telling us really terrible stories about how they all very actively fight the occupation in any way they can, either by having groups of people assemble to have boycotts or do rallies or protests. So one of them was too vocal on Facebook, put a post about freeing Palestine, not liking Israel, things like that. The Israeli army decided, someone in the Israeli government decided that it was too much, and they invaded that refugee camp trying to kill this guy. And he was telling about the story how his neighbor was calling for help, and his wife was pregnant at the time and was having a baby, and he opened the door and bullets went through the open door and hit the wall behind him, and his wife started to have a miscarriage. And he was trying to help his wife, and as he was helping his wife, he saw his best friend get shot through the open door. And then he was telling us stories like this aren't uncommon. Everyone in these kind of situations has a relative who's either in jail or got shot or multiple relatives. And that carries over to the middle class and also to the upper class, the people who are in power. But the effect on each one is different because you have people who are very poor and can't really do anything about it versus people who have a lot more power. And although they all are also struggling from the occupation because their sense of privilege is it's an illusion. They don't actually have any sense of privilege because Israel can take it away from them just as easily as they gave it to them. The Palestinian Authority is a joke. There's no leadership. There's no direction of leadership. There's no one that the people trust. There's no one that the people follow. The Fatah and Hamas, people are divided, but at the same time, no one really supports either. It really fluctuates back and forth between really supporting and not supporting at all. It's a very unstable situation in general. The Palestinian Authority, the police, are paid by Israel, so they have the illusion of being Palestinians, policing Palestinians, but at the same time, Israel is the one paying the salaries. So if the Palestinian police don't do what Israel wants, their salaries get stopped, and this happens all the time. Also bad. Living in Jerusalem, because we live in a Palestinian neighborhood, we already get things secondhand. Living in the West Bank, you get things thirdhand. So in Jerusalem, there are a lot of times where our trash doesn't get picked up, and then the trash just overflows onto the sidewalk for days and days and days. There are times when your power gets cut off, when you don't get water, because that the way it works is Israel controls all of the resources, and then they decide who gets what and when. So if there wasn't enough water because there is some kind of drought or some kind of problem, after Israel gets their water, it gets distributed to the settlements first, then it goes to Palestinian residents. So sometimes we wouldn't get water. That problem only got worse when we live in the West Bank. So the way it works in the West Bank is you have a tank of water on the top of your house. It gets filled once a month. If it runs out, then you don't have water. So you think about things in a completely different way. You start thinking about them in, do I have enough water to shower, or should I wait and do laundry? And it's just a completely different way of looking at things. We don't get electricity goes off once a week, maybe twice, but still, again, we have it better than a lot of other people who get it off 4 or 5 times a week. And then nothing is compared to Gaza, who don't have electricity except for 2 hours a day out of 24. So keeping all these things in mind, the situation only gets worse as you move down, just the privilege chain. Those are some of the very big differences in Jerusalem. There are all, in the West Bank, there are also a lot of cultural differences. People are a little bit more open. People call it, like where I live in Ramallah, they call it the Ramallah bubble because you have the illusion of being free, and the society kind of sometimes forgets. I think all of that really did change this summer, though, because after the kidnapping of the 3 Israelis, we got raids all the time where Israeli soldiers would come in and, like, break all the shops, break the glass. It was a really, really... I think this summer was an exception, though, or it was a throwback to 60 years ago when I wasn't born. But it was definitely the most unstable and violent summer I've ever lived through. Banks got robbed all the time by Israelis. They would just break the glass and, like, take stuff. Schools, computer stores. So that's another big difference. In Jerusalem, you have people who are more religious, more closed-minded. You have people who don't necessarily have to deal with the occupation on a day-to-day basis, because they don't have to go through checkpoints, but there's a very strong Israeli presence because at the end of the day, you're living exactly next to all the settlements. So my house in Jerusalem was right next to one of the biggest settlements with the biggest mall. And that's kind of, everything is pretty intertwined. So there are Israeli buses and Palestinian buses, and people usually don't mix, even though there are no laws against it, but people just usually don't. But for example, the train is, everyone uses the train. So you'll be sitting next to Israelis, you'll be sitting next to Palestinians, because I know there's like a misconception that it's very segregated, but that's just really not true. Walking on streets, everyone walks together. There aren't usually very many clashes like, oh, like you're Israeli or you're very obviously Palestinian. But there is a form of discrimination, for example, in stores. Whenever me and my friends go to a mall, we'll speak English because we don't want them to know we're Arabs, because then we're going to be followed in like the store because they don't trust us. Definitely there are some people who start problems, but in general people live together, not in peace, but in acceptance of the situation. What else?
Are you aware of people who lived in homes in the West Bank that were destroyed by Israeli tanks?
Absolutely. One of my best friends, her house, so building permits is a very huge issue because it's almost impossible to get a building permit. You first have to apply to build on your land, even if the land that you have is yours. You have to apply for a permit. It usually takes them about 8 to 9 years to respond to your permit request, and then usually the answer 80% of the time is no. So what people end up doing is they build without the permits. The minute you build without a permit, it means that Israel has the right to come and demolish your house. So I have friends whose houses have been demolished. My most recent memory is my friend who lives in Jerusalem, her house was going to be demolished because they don't have a permit, but they were able to work out a deal and ended up closing four of the six rooms. So now the family is living in two rooms instead of six. And the way they closed them is they plastered the doors closed, and then they'll do periodic checks to make sure you haven't opened the doors. By plastered, I mean they'll add a wall in front of the door. So you'd have to actively get a construction crew to come and knock it down, but they do these routine checks, and you never know when. So it's impossible. So now they're living in two rooms all squished together. And that's one of the lucky stories, the success stories, because their house wasn't demolished.
Does the Israeli government give any excuse for people not being allowed to live in six rooms but having to live in
It's their excuse for demolishing the house is, well, you built without a permit.
Yeah, but from six to two,
No, it's really random. It's what you can work out. A lot of it's like, if you have a little bit more power, a little bit more wealth, you can negotiate a deal where they'll let you have two rooms. Because they're relatively wealthy, they were like, I'll pay the fine, but let me keep these two rooms open. Most people don't have that option.
What about water? Is the Israeli government give any reason for not being able to give the settlers and the Palestinians water?
They usually do, but if they don't, then they say it runs out. And that's not really an excuse. But, it runs out and they give the settlements first, always. Settlements have first priority, always. This summer... Yeah, go ahead, sorry. I was just going to say that this summer was really... After the kidnappings, everyone was afraid to go out into the street. You had... All of a sudden, everything changed. There were stories of kidnappings all the time. You heard of... Was on this one Facebook group where people would report what cars were driving around. I don't know if you got it on your news, but we had one of the kids in the neighborhood right next to mine in Jerusalem. He got kidnapped by Israelis, and they fed him gasoline and then burned him on fire. And then they found him in the forest a few days later. And after that, of course, the Palestinian community exploded. He was one of the kids from one of the biggest families. And because Palestinian families are really big, they're 50 cousins in a family, 60 cousins, 70 cousins in a family. And that whole area, it's about 10, by car 2 minutes, but a 10, 20-minute walk away from my house. Whole area completely shut down, tear gas every day. They destroyed the train. The Palestinians destroyed the Israeli train. They didn't want the train going past there. Huge demonstrations every day. And it was all tied together to the constant... Israel arrested 600 people from Hebron during that time. Just crazy raids, crazy destruction. But that summer was very, everyone was very, very scared, very overwhelmed. I remember I was going to visit my friend because I was about to come to America, and I wanted to be able to say goodbye, and I remember walking in the street and not seeing anyone else. And then I remember someone from the window kept saying, you should go inside, like you shouldn't be outside right now. And my friends weren't allowed to come visit me because their parents were scared. So everyone was just too scared to leave the house in case they would get kidnapped. Because there were very real cases where in broad daylight people would try to kidnap other people. It's a very, very strange situation. But then you'd have all of these rumors of things that actually weren't happening, but people just spreading rumors about a white car that has this license plate and a black car that's been seen in this area. So it was just a lot of confusion and anger and sadness. So pretty hard time.
This is great, very informative. I was in Aberdeen the year before last, had a sabbatical, and so I was on a teaching assignment at El Quds University in Aberdeen, and it would take an hour just to get from there to East Jerusalem because of what you just said, the security checkpoints and everything. And so before I got there, like a week before I got there, a home was demolished right in front of this separation wall. And I met the owner of the house a few weeks later, just purely by accident. I was in his store, and he said, his home got demolished. And he said the reason that they gave him was that he only had a permit to build one story, and it was three stories. And it was non-negotiable. They just demolished the house.
That happens all the time.
And so yeah. I said, so what are you going to do now? And he said, God help me. Mm-hmm. And he said the worst thing is not only that they demolished the house, but they have to pay for the privilege of having the house demolished, because they also have to pay the fine to take away the...
You have to pay for the truck that comes and demolishes your house. You have to pay for that. Israel doesn't pay for that, because technically you're the one who broke the law. So, and that happens all the time with the one floor or a certain number of square feet, and you build a little over that, and they have an excuse to demolish your house. Yeah, all the time.
And twice, at least twice that I know about, at that hairpin turn between El Azariah and Bethany on the way to Aberdeen, it was closed, and the dumpsters were turned upside down and set on fire, and there was rioting and tear gas, but no one told me why. Yeah. I don't know what was going on at the time.
Checkpoint,
I got stopped twice. Once I had to walk home, and I didn't know the way, and it was late at night, and I just asked some total strangers for a ride.
Yeah.
They were very nice. Mm-hmm. It was interesting.
Checkpoint.
Nobody was scared. But that's what.
No one's scared. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, go ahead.
They just went about their business like, oh, no big deal.
See, it's pretty regular. When I talk about like going to school and the struggles I face, everyone is always like, aren't you scared when you're like walking through the tear gas? The thing is, it's such a regular routine thing that no one. It's more an inconvenience where you go, oh, today they're throwing rocks. Or like, oh, today there's tear gas, unless I'm really scared for my life, I hope I don't get hurt. It's a lot less of that and more of a, well, I'm now going to be late to school. Oh, well. So I think once you get to that point, it's also saying something pretty strong, a pretty strong message. Checkpoints, there's something called flyaway checkpoints, I think, something like that. It means that a checkpoint can spring up at any time, any place. For no reason. But also, the kids who decide to protest, there's not really usually a logical path. There's not a reason why. It's more like, today, let's protest. Throwing rocks could be controversial, because at the end of the day, it really doesn't accomplish anything. Usually, the kids who are throwing the rocks end up not being able to get them far enough, and it ends up hitting your car, and it's like, but you just broke my window. But this, at the same time, youth feel so... they don't feel like they have any way of instigating change. So I completely understand where they come from with the throwing the rocks, because they feel like they can't do anything else, and they need some way to act, to show that they're resisting, to show that they're not okay with the situation. But I don't think throwing rocks does anything except start more. It also allows Israel to have an excuse to jail a lot of kids. In Palestine, in Israel, you can be held with no charges. And I know that's pretty strange. Most countries, you have to have a reason why you're being taken to jail. You can be held with no charges in Israel for as long as they see fit. Also, they make you confess by torture. Very well known, happens to a lot of people all the time. As soon as you confess, they can keep you in jail for a life prison, like a life state, a lifelong period. So pretty rough situation. For example, in Hebron, when they took the 600 people to prison, there was outrage, lots of riots, lots of rallies, and they released a few of them only to arrest all of the people they released. They got them in jail. They arrested them a week later for a different charge, unrelated. But it's kind of different tricks that the Israeli government is able to play because they have the power to keep the population quiet, but also keep the international community quiet. Because once there was so much outrage over them arresting 600 people, the international community got very upset, and Israel said they released them. And then they weren't held accountable when they arrested them for the second time because no one knew. And you didn't hear any media attention about it. So that's also pretty frustrating.
Carol said that your mother is an activist. Is there a particular group that she is part of?
My mother, she's American. She started an organization called Dalia Association that works with empowering minority groups in Palestine, such as women or small villages, but without taking any international aid. And there's a very long process behind it and why she doesn't believe international aid is the reason, that I completely believe in. But that's not really activism, that's more community building, and her activism is mostly solo activism because she has a blog where she has a lot of friends in Gaza. So my dad works for the United Nations, so he spends 1 week with us. He spends 2 weeks with us and 1 week in Gaza because that's where his main focus is. So my mom has also been to Gaza and has a lot of connections there, a lot of friends. She's done trainings and programs. She has not been allowed access the last 3 times she's tried. They just haven't let her in. But through her blog, she's able to interview her friends, and she puts them online, and that's probably her biggest form of activism, because people don't know their stories, and everyone there wants to tell their story. So she contacts them, she sets up the camera, so they have the talk, and then she puts it on her blog. It's something like The View from My Window in Palestine. Her name is Nora Lestermrod, if you wanted to look at it. I think she was a lot more active in her youth, but that's the media outreach is what she does now. She also writes a lot of articles for different.
And what's happening in Hebron right now?
I haven't been home for a year, and I talk to my parents, I talk to my friends, but it's really, really hard to fully understand when you're not there. And I think some of my frustration was, why don't other people care? Why don't other people know? And some of it is definitely media, but a lot of it is you just really don't know the details if you're not there. So what I've heard is that it's just as bad. Nothing's changed. But I haven't been back there, so it's going to be... I'm looking forward to being able to see for myself.
You might go on the tour Breaking the Silence does. They're Israeli soldiers who take... people internationally, and also now they've started to take Israeli citizens to raise the awareness of what happens there. And it's an amazing, you know, going there is amazing, to see what people have to go through and live.
Yeah. Last summer, it's killed the economy there. They were, like, everyone knows that shoes from Hebron are the best shoes. That's completely gone now. They don't produce any as much as they used to. A lot of people are in jail still, so I don't really know how it's changed, but I've heard that it's only gone worse, unfortunately.
The United, our government is very, very closely tied to the Israeli government. Do you use the word Israel? You use the word. And you're a citizen of Israel. Your family are citizens. So theoretically, our government is the ally of the Arabs who live there. But what is the experience of these people, of this relationship with the United States? Would they like us to do something?
Mm-hmm. So there's one distinction you have to make. Even though we're citizens of Israel, we're still Israeli Arabs. Israel makes a very clear distinction. So we have Israeli passports. That does not mean we're treated the same as Israelis. We were trying to buy a home, and we weren't allowed to because my dad's Arab. They wouldn't let us. The minute they'd find out, they wouldn't sell us the house. I remember years and years and years of my parents trying to scheme away by letting my mom go alone, meeting the family alone. She's obviously American. She's white. So they would send my mom alone the first 3 times, and then my dad would only come to sign the papers. And they'd see him and say, sorry, we forgot we sold the house. And we'd have the papers in front of us. So the clear signs of discrimination. My dad's pretty dark-skinned. He's very obviously Arab. So even though
you're familiar with this stuff here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Darker-skinned people.
It's very, very similar. Discrimination, racism is the same in different forms. So even though we're citizens of Israel because of the Israeli passport, we still get stopped going through the airport for 4 or 5 hours, whereas Israeli citizens don't. So we're not actually Israeli citizens. And that's, we don't call ourselves that because we don't want to be associated, because we don't believe in it, but also because we're not treated the same anyway. In how Palestinians see America, really wish the American government would stop interfering. Feel like the common perception, and something I believe too, is Israel would not be able to exist without America. They wouldn't have the resources that they have now. Money, weapons, support, international support. The international community largely doesn't support Israel. It's really only America and whatever countries America is able to convince to support Israel. So, I mean, there's no hatred towards Americans at all, which is something I hear a lot. Like, do you guys hate Americans? Like, do you hate Israelis? It's a lot less of that and more of, we understand that you're the ones with the power and we wish you'd do something differently because you're causing the suffering. Israel is too, but everyone associates America with Israel. The minute you hear Israel, you hear America too. I heard someone say something about in Gaza, a lot of the bombs they made in the USA on them. And when you see a missile that just demolished your house or killed your relative and it very clearly says made in USA, it's going to cause feelings of anger towards that country. So there are definitely feelings of anger and association between Israel and America. But I think it's more recognition that a lot of the power lies with America to make the change.
That was Serene Morad speaking about her experiences growing up in Palestine. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts at any time, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.